We are fortunate today to actually have three guests joining us for the session. Our first speaker is Kevin Real. Kevin may be a familiar face to some of you who've come to a past AGM session. He was here and he presented to us on ethics previously. He's also the voice on the audio clips in COTBC's ethics learning module. So if you've had a chance to listen to that, you might recognize the voice. Also with us today is Dr. Heidi Otter. Dr. Otter joined the College of Physicians and Surgeons of BC as a deputy registrar in May 2004 and was responsible for many portfolios including ethics, quality assurance, and peer review, and the prescription review and methadone programs. In 2008, she was appointed to the position of registrar and CEO, where she's accountable for ensuring compliance with statutory obligations, implementing and monitoring the policies and strategic directions set forth by the board, and managing the daily operations and administration. And finally, but certainly not least, Cynthia Johansson. Cynthia is the registrar and CEO of the College of Registered Nurses of British Columbia. Cynthia joined the college in 2006 as the Director of Registration, Inquiry, and Discipline. She became the registrar or CEO in April of 2012. And previous to this, Cynthia served as the registrar and CEO of the College of Dental Hygienists in BC. So without much further ado, over to Kevin. Thank you all very much and welcome today.
Thank you, Andrea. This, without a doubt, is a topic that cuts to the core of everybody's values, which means that it touches very deep into the heart of everybody's own self-identity. And I hope I don't say anything or convey anything that causes any affront and gives me the impression of being insensitive. So catch me out if I do. Tell me afterwards. Write a little note about what I said and pass it to me and explain it to me. I'm hoping that that won't happen, and I'm hoping that we will have a useful session. So effectively, we're here. You know why we're here. We're here to look at this new dimension of healthcare practice in Canada, assisted dying, and to look at it, I always like to look at it in the context of high-quality end-of-life care. Some people want to hive it off for very good reasons of their own, but I like to see it all as part and parcel. And of course, we're looking at it in the context of occupational therapy practice and what OTs might be doing or not doing or could be doing around high-quality end-of-life care where MAID is or is not part of it all. So we'll look at some ethics again. I'm an ethicist. We'll look at the federal and the provincial legislation around it. That's why I'm so happy to have my esteemed colleagues here to fill in on the provincial bit, which I don't know quite as much about at all, in the BC context anyways. And then we'll look at some of the potential roles for occupational therapists in end-of-life care and MAID in particular. Many of you know that we conducted a survey a couple years ago across Canada of OTs and their views on this issue and what they might offer or might not offer. And then a very nice group of you responded to the invite to be part of a reflective exercise a couple weeks ago. And so I've got a few of the little bits and pieces that garnered from that. In both cases, I didn't necessarily expect to find any kind of incredibly indicative data. It was just a sort of litmus test, a kind of finger in the wind about where is occupational therapy and where are occupational therapists at on this. And it was also a chance, many people said in their responses, to actually reflect on the issue in a very different way than just having a conversation while the news was on. So we'll also look very much at the interprofessional roles because, as we all know, medical and nurse practitioners are critical in this. But many people will tell you who have gone through any kind of protracted end-of-life scenario with their loved ones that a lot of other health professionals are absolutely essential to that being as good as it could be, given what it is. And also look at what you offered as suggestions for potential college resources to be offered here. So first of all, a little review from 3 years ago. Ethics, that big word, is really about just determining good and bad, right and wrong. And a colleague of mine loves to, and it's really quite useful, you think about the things you could do that are defensible legally and ethically, and then out of that, you've got to pick out the one that you should do or you should try first. And it sounds really simple as that. It ain't anywhere near as simple as that. It's a little more like this. I think this should be a prize to anybody who can really say in 10 words or less what that sign means. So, and then what we talked about last time around was the idea that ethics happens to us, both in personal life and in practice, and I've got three words that sum it up quite distinctly. You get a yuck. And that's this gut feeling that something's wrong. And then you start thinking about the muck that is behind that yuck. And it's typically things to do with, is this a good example? Is this legal? Is this moral? Can I defend this? What will this look like if it's on the front page of the Globe and Mail? All those kinds of things. Who might be upset if I do this, or who might be upset if I do that? What's the outcome going to be in the end? What's the difference in the outcomes? One can only imagine that people like Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are endlessly trying not to think about the muck because they've mired themselves in it rather well. And then what you aim for when you want to be an ethical practitioner or just another good human being is what I picked a word that rhymes, okay, it's pluck. And pluck is an old word for a sense of fortitude or a sense of certainty about what you should do and why you should do it. The thing about pluck is, it's where you get to when you've sifted through a lot of the muck, but it won't necessarily take away the yuck. It'll help keep the yuck in check and help you understand why you feel yucky about something. Imagine having to discipline your kid or your partner, or tell a very good friend something as onerous as their partner's having an affair or their haircut isn't quite what they think it is in terms of attractiveness. There's still some yuck there, but if you think through the muck, you might decide that you're going to say or not say either of those issues. We typically work through the muck by thinking about these things we call values and principles. And then in practice, we have our value set, our personal one and our professional one. And with that, we expect that they will make the world a better place. And we do that by applying them through principles that we then bring to the skill sets that we offer to our clients every day. So that's how they offer this kind of fundamental foundation to good practice in the end. You're working typically from a value set, and when you're at the front end and trying to apply your skills, and it's really confusing about whether this is feeling good or not, it's touching right back to those values, which is why in the case of assisted dying, it feels like what we have to do at the skills end, the actual action end, might not entirely rest at ease with the principles and the values that are informing our life and our practice. So when we asked OTs across Canada what values they identified as principal in OT practice, we took a bunch of values kind of words out of professional documents and gave them a list. And then we were a little bit cruel. I had a yuck factor about this. We said, just pick three. So when we forced the choice, the one that came out on top was client-centered practice by far. And I have to say, I did breathe a sigh of relief because I thought that's what should come out on top. And then the other one was respect, which is great, meaning, which is great. And then the other ones were very clearly identified as worthy by many people. But it's this interesting thing about a field that feels itself primarily driven by a value of client-centered practice. What kind of yuck is that setting us up for when a client might end up asking us to do something or be involved in something as part of a team providing care that just doesn't feel like it feels good to us, but this is precisely what a very reflective and well-informed, capable client is saying they feel is best for them. So it's really going to be difficult in many cases to feel really wonderful about client-centered practice when that client is asking for something that just feels kind of profoundly yucky, as it does to many people. The other thing is that just always reminding ourselves that this is part of a long menu of what can happen when somebody is facing an end-of-life care situation. And in practice, what happens is people may actually request this, go through formal requests and formal preparation for it, and ultimately decide to hold off on it. And many people actually don't even take advantage of it in the end. But what they want is this option, that if they need to do this, they can do this. And the stats are something like in Oregon, where what happens is you get a prescription and you then get a medication that you then take on your own. A lot more people get the prescription than ever actually have the prescription dispensed. It's about a third that don't actually use it in the end. And it's just about having that option in case I can't actually make it. So there is classic palliative care, managing physical and psychoexistential pain, typically defined as a point at which where we're not seeking a curative treatment necessarily. That said, some people who are still in curative treatment may need a palliative pain consult because the pain is so great that it's the palliative care physicians who know best about how far they can go with these things. There's palliative sedation, which is this idea that if we can't actually control your pain, what we could do, if you wish, is put you in a pretty deep sleep until your body finally dies and you don't have to actually feel that pain. Not something that everybody would want to do, but something that some people do regularly. And then there's this other thing that is part of end-of-life care and has been for years as well, which is withdrawing life-sustaining treatments, including things like artificial nutrition and hydration. So if I have ended up in a position where I'm dependent on one of these things, without ever asking for assisted dying, I can actually just ask to have that withheld. That's within my rights. And then I can also ask for something to be withdrawn. So if it's been started, I can say stop. It gets really complex because then you get into things like implantable cardioverter defibrillators, which are inside there. And you can easily deprogram the defibrillator, but it still is a pacer. And I found out a lot of that working with the nurse practitioners when one of my last jobs. And then there's this thing about voluntary stopping eating and drinking, which is what a lot of people do. And it's something that's often happening without us really knowing because they don't discuss it. And it's part of a realm of events that is poorly tracked called passive suicide, where people don't discuss their wishes. They just do it this way. We now have a national framework for integrated palliative care, which will hopefully help make things a little bit better. It came out just before MAID was in the process of being legalized. So there's an interesting relationship between palliative care and assisted dying that is a particular Canadian one, very different than the one that evolved in places like Belgium and the Netherlands, where palliative care physicians were doing this and wanted it legalized. Here, it's kind of the opposite way around. So we'll see what happens with this over time. For ethics in OT, we have a lot of decision-making tools. So the College of OT, of course, has its code of ethics. CAOT has its framework for ethics. And then, as sometimes happens with specific issues, you take a particular deep dive in ethics. So we've done this around things like pandemic planning and said, well, which principles are particularly important here? And there's been much written about that. More recently, we've done it around the critical shortage of intravenous medications, which has caused a lot of problems and a lot of really anxiety-provoking moments where we don't have enough IV meds to go around. So how do you make those determinations? And also, as of late, medical cannabis and how you actually implement a medical cannabis policy at a place like the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, where I used to work. So what we did at the Joint Center for Bioethics was we did a specific discussion paper around assisted dying and implementing it in Canada, and we looked at which ethics principles were the most relevant ones. And the trouble with doing that is that we did it in a vacuum, so the law hadn't been changed yet. We knew a lot of things that we'd read and done. So we wrote as best we could at the time. We'd probably edit it now if we rewrote it. But what we ended up with was a list of principles. And so one list of principles here is the College of OT's list. The other list was from our discussion paper. Anybody recognize which one is which? It's not a test. Bravo. One on the left is the college. So why did we come up with different principles? Oh, good Lord. Well, the fact is, when you know the principles enough, you can actually figure out which ones are speaking to the same thing. So all the highlighted ones here are covered in the other set, which is most of them. And then what's interesting is, when we asked you, you came up with the underlined ones as the ones that were most relevant. So you've got most of them in most sets. And then the purple ones were the ones that came out on top as most important ones to you, in your personal ethics at least. So you're really big on autonomy, which is basically client-centered practice, and fairness, which is also wonderful to hear. You also added in a few others like client-centered practice itself and integrity. And then if you map them, they all map rather well onto each other. So we're not speaking to different purposes, we're just using different points of departure when we pick one word over the other. And then some will prevail, like client-centered practice. So that's where we're at now. Beyond the ethical parameters here, legally, we've got things that are legal and not legal around when people are have their lives ended. So there's this thing that's been called physician-assisted suicide, which I've put in quotes and italics because I don't like the word in this context. And we found out since Bill C-14 that in Canada, it's both medical and nurse practitioner assisted. There's something called voluntary active euthanasia, something called voluntary passive euthanasia, and there's something else that is not legal called involuntary euthanasia, which happens against somebody's will. It's unethical, so it's just entirely off the table. The difficulty is this word euthanasia keeps getting muddled up in people's minds, and people think all these things. But this one is just not there. Anybody able to tell me what euthanasia actually means, its root words? It doesn't actually mean dark horrors of the Holocaust, which is what first comes to mind, because that was the most extraordinary thing to have happened probably so far to humanity. Strangely, despite its association with the Nazi period, it means good death. It's a laudable end that comes out of Greece, and even Hippocrates in a different way. You want to keep people comfortable and give them as good a death as possible, which might work out to the least worst death in many cases. So euthanasia is actually seeking to do good at the time of death. So with voluntary passive euthanasia, this is actually legal and ethical and has been in practice for many years. And this is about withdrawing and withholding things. So you might not start antibiotics for somebody who develops a pneumonia. You might withdraw breathing support for somebody who's dependent on a breather. They may capably request this, as has happened plenty of times with me in my ethics practice. They may not be capable of requesting it, but their substitute decision maker may say, this is what they would want if they could stand here, look at themselves, and make this decision. So this has been happening in ICUs, palliative care units, and various other places for years, and it's considered what you have to do when you have a capable request to do this, or a substitute decision maker's request that's deemed legitimate within the law. The other ones that are here in the middle, they're now decriminalized. So C-14, that bill that changed things, isn't itself a law. It changed the criminal code. And the criminal code now has a carve-out that says, despite the fact that murder is wrong and a criminal offense, and despite the fact that assisting somebody to kill themselves is a criminal offense, it doesn't apply here. There's an exemption, and that exemption is all around made. So the first one is where somebody just gets assistance through the means of a prescription, and then the pharmacist would dispense it. And then at that point, the person can take it on their own at their will according to their plan. From what I hear, it's not the favorite approach among most of the professionals I work with, because they much prefer to make sure that it happens really, really well, and they'd rather be there so that nothing goes wrong. The other one is when you're involved in a more hands-on way and you actually administer the medication, usually by IV, and that in most cases typically involves a nurse who sets up the IV, and then the physician or nurse practitioner will come and actually administer the meds. So there's a dividing line between this middle one and the one on the far left, which tells you what's been legal and not legal until now. It tells you what people say is the difference between what's been moral and what they might say is still immoral, depending on what their take on assisted dying is. But for me, what that line has always shown is effectively where you end up, what I call the perverse lottery of end of life. If you were on the left of that line, you were one of the lucky, unlucky folks who is facing a situation where you may think that you want to die sooner than you would do otherwise, if you were kept alive. But you have every right to say, stop this or don't do that, because there's something that's needed to keep you alive. If you're in the middle there, on the right-hand side of that line, you've not had that bit of weird luck in this perverse lottery, because you've actually needed somebody to do something to bring it about. And what people have done is then they've stopped eating or drinking, and they've had a longer, slower process of death. The gentleman in Quebec who actually stopped eating and drinking for 2 weeks so that he would be so ill that he would actually qualify for assistance in dying, because he wouldn't get it otherwise. So there's very, very strange stories and experiences that can come out of this. And hopefully what's happened now with this breaking of the line between the two legally is that it's made things a little bit fairer. And what it's also done is it's only ever done it as an option for those who want it. So nowhere in here is anybody expected to be doing this. And the legislation specifically says that there should be no undue influence on somebody, no coercion to do this. And we have to always look out for that. So this is the Carter carve-out. And what happens is that's the federal criminal code that's been changed to offer this carve-out. There's now an exemption from prosecution for people who are involved in assisting a death in this very active way, if it falls in line with what is described as made. The other thing that gets a little bit confusing in this circumstance is the difference between treatment and other care. So you may all know of this woman named Margot Bentley, who's in a long-term care home. She was the subject of a very fine documentary on the Sunday edition called In the Presence of a Spoon, who has a very involved advance directive saying that she wouldn't want any kind of life-sustaining treatment. She's in advanced dementia. The trouble is that she still responds by opening her mouth when a spoon of food is presented to her cheek or her lips. And the long-term care home says that they can't deny the necessities of life. And it's not medical treatment. It's just care. So it gets really murky, which is why the whole issue of advance directives around MAID is that much more complex and isn't available at the moment and may become or may not become available in a few years' time. So as we said, MAID is these two things. The first is the active one, where medical or nurse practitioner is actually administering. And the second is the prescribing of a medication that can then be sought and sorted. There's various safeguards in place in the criminal code now, which includes safeguards. The purple ones are for the practitioners, which means they've got an exemption. And then there are other safeguards that are aimed at protecting the people who might be making requests. Probably know about most of them. Written request, it has to be witnessed by two people, a 10-day reflection period, two independent assessors, making sure that this person's eligible, and specific requirements around the independence of the witnesses and the practitioners that are confirming eligibility. And then there's the basic eligibility criteria around you have to be an adult, you have to be capable, you have to have a grievous and irremediable condition. More on that in a moment. It has to be voluntary. It has to be done in a position of informed consent about all of your options. And you have to be somebody who's eligible for government-funded healthcare in Canada, which means that we won't be allowed to offer this to somebody who comes to Canada looking for it, like so many Canadians that have gone to Switzerland looking for it there. So we're not opening up that door at the moment. And then grievous and irremediable was the one that occupied a lot of debate. And this is what it ended up being defined as, which is in some ways a little bit like that road sign about parking. So it's serious and incurable. You are in an advanced state of irreversible decline in capability. You have enduring physical or psychological suffering that's intolerable to you. And then the last one that was much debated was natural death has become reasonably foreseeable, though we don't need a prognosis and we don't need a kind of time estimate. So there's a lot of like very wishy-washy words in there. And interestingly, a big think tank I respect in the UK called the Nuffield Council on Bioethics did a big project about what is natural in the minds of people. And they found out that there's no real consensus at all and vast variation on what is natural. And one of their primary recommendations after this long and very thorough project was don't ever use this word in law and public policy. But here we got it. So now we have to work with it. And the one thing I can kind of say is that I'm so glad because it's other people, other practitioners, the poor medical and nurse practitioners who are going to have to deal with these criteria and make sure that they're meeting them, despite any kind of little worries that somebody could challenge it. And again, trying to be client-centered, one of the biggest concerns in a lot of people's practice is litigation. And if you feel like you could be seen to be going against this, then it's a problem. So what we'll do is pass it over now to my colleagues to go on a little bit more about how it works in the provincial regulated context here and within their professions.
Thank you very much, Kevin. So you've just heard that the eligibility criteria around serious and incurable, an advanced state, enduring physical or psychological suffering, and that death has become reasonably foreseeable. And people like to say, well, is that 2 weeks, 2 months, 6 months, 2 years? And I can't add any further clarity to this, I'm sorry, except to go to the website. And the ministry said this is not death on demand. It's balancing for those for whom death is clearly in their crosshairs, the option of choosing a peaceful death over a death that is likely to cause tremendous suffering. And that was decided in the Carter case to be a charter right. And yes, it's now found in amendments to the criminal code. So it's where we're at. And speaking as a regulator, I just would like to start with a disclaimer that this will be the most profound social policy change that I will experience in my lifetime as a physician. It's controversial. People are deeply divided about this. People have very strong opinions. But as a regulator, our interest is always public interest. And we have, as a regulator, a responsibility to set ethical and professional standards. So it's not about being for or against medical assistance in dying. It's about what is the public interest when people have a lawful right to access a service. And that's where I start from. And I also just want to apologize to those people who are in the palliative care world. We understand that the concept of medical assistance in dying is a phrase that many of the palliative care community believe they own. And they don't like the word medical assistance in dying. They believe it should be hasten death or plan death or some other phrase. However, we are regulators. We're highly legalistic. And that phrase tracks directly from C-14. Which was the criminal code amendment, so we'll just use that. The Carter decision set out very nicely that the medical model, and I use the word medical rather loosely to really recognize the broad range of practitioners who fall within the medical world, that the concept of free and informed consent could be the basis under which people would access assistance in dying. And of course, the Carter decision talked about physician-assisted dying, and I'm very pleased that we've moved on to the more inclusive term medical assistance in dying to recognize that it is, in fact, a team of practitioners who work with patients. So what does that free and informed consent model really look like? It means that the patient has been given all of the relevant information that they need to make informed decisions about their health care. It means that they have also been given, because it's in the criminal code amendments, information about palliative care and other end-of-life options. So again, it's not either or. It's about a range of options that people have in front of them. We value autonomy in our society, and patients are allowed to make free and informed decisions. So they don't have to go to a panel and get approved, right? This is a decision between the practitioners and the patient. And our expectation of physicians is that they must have an adequate medical record that includes all of that information. So they need to be documenting the patient's diagnosis, prognosis, treatment options, that they've been given information about palliative care, that they really understand the values and beliefs of their patient, that this patient is making a decision free of any coercion or undue influence. And when I speak to groups of physicians, I really remind them that they have a duty to act in the best interest of the patient. And that may not be simply saying, sure, I will do that for you, right? It is, are you satisfying yourself as well that the patient isn't marginalized, isn't a victim in their current domestic relationship or a family relationship, that they are in fact able to make this decision, because capability is an important aspect of this, that they aren't being seen as a burden to the family, that they aren't otherwise vulnerable. And I see many of these roles as roles where you, as a member of the healthcare team, can be of assistance in those kind of discussions. there is an important role for everybody to document. And always somebody always puts their hand up in the crowd and says, could I be sued for this? And I say, yep. So even if the patient meets the criteria, you've done everything, everything's okay. It doesn't mean that the daughter-in-law from California isn't going to fly home at the last minute and be the fly in the ointment and all of this. So for practitioners, your best defense is a good, sound documentation and a record of what you've done. We do have provincial forms, and the use of those provincial forms, they're administrative, but they were designed to be, at a glance, collaboration for the healthcare team. So you've got this thing about two opinions and the pharmacist dispensing to the practitioner and all of that. But it was really meant to serve as at-a-glance collaboration and a checklist so that everybody's kind of made sure that all the moving parts and pieces are there. But they're not tied to any particular law in British Columbia. So the way we've made the provincial forms mandatory is they're simply in our practice standards. With time, we may see actual provincial law coming in on top of the federal law. But what we have are some amendments to how we do healthcare in British Columbia. So, for instance, for the practice of medicine, the Minister of Health made it a requirement in our regulations that we had to set standards for this type of practice. I believe the same was put in for the College of Registered Nurses. We have had the regulations for nurse practitioners amended, so they're actually allowed to prescribe the substances that are used in this, so they are now authorized through that process to be part of the provider aspect here. And we also have an amendment to the Coroner's Act that allows the coroner to then serve as the oversight and monitoring piece. And that was certainly an important aspect of the federal legislation, is this expectation that there shall be public reporting. And again, big social change, it's imperative that there be public reporting. One of the things the Minister of Health in British Columbia asked us to do when we were developing our practice standards was to be certain that the use of telemedicine could be incorporated in this process. And that was largely around the fact that we do have rural, remote areas of the province, and simply finding two practitioners who aren't actually conflicted might be problematic. We recognize and respect that there is conscientious objection for many providers, so there kind of need to be some workarounds around that. So we did bring in our practice standard, the ability for one, but not both, of the assessments to be conducted by telemedicine. But the caveat in that is we said there needed to be another regulated health professional in the room to be a witness to that consultation. And they're not there to be anything but impartial and independent to make sure that, again, that whole concept of coercion, arm twisting, whatever, that again, so they're kind of a witness to, if you like, that informed consent discussion. The provincial forms are actually now many. There's a requirement for the patient to use a provincial form when they want to request medical assistance in dying, and that needs to be signed by two independent people who aren't involved in their healthcare. Then there's an assessor form, and then what we call the prescriber form, because it's somebody's got to actually write the prescription. If there's any question about the patient's ability to consent or the capability, there's actually another form for assessment of that, if that's in question. There's a checklist. There's now also a coroner's reporting form, and that does need to be completed by whoever was the prescriber in this process. We do have a standard, or do have in our standard, an expectation that the prescriber stays with the patient until death is confirmed. And as you've alluded, most of the patients are being provided with intravenous routes to death. And that's largely because we don't have good oral medications. And this actually tracks back to the fact that in the United States, they have capital punishment, and the drug companies in Europe make the drugs, and they don't want to sell the drugs to be used for this purpose. So anyways, when I started practice, because I actually should have said I just graduated a long time ago, as opposed to actually saying it was many, many decades ago, Seconal was in use. And Seconal fell out of favor because patients accidentally overdosed on it all the time. So we have much safer drugs now to use for sedation and hypnosis, sleep aids, etc. So those drugs are not readily available. And so that's why the IV route is preferred. Because of the very high failure rate with the existing cocktails that exist for the oral route, and I think there have been some oral uses in British Columbia, what we didn't want is it to not be successful, and then the family is in angst, and how many hours go by when somebody's deeply comatose, and worse, somebody calls 911. I mean, that's really not the point of it. So the physician or nurse practitioner needs to stay until death is confirmed, just to make sure that it is a completed task. In British Columbia, we have taken a route to reconcile those who have conscientious objection against the autonomous rights of patients to make free and informed consent to access lawful medical services. And we have not required that the practitioner make a formal referral when their patient asks for this, when they're not prepared to be involved. And that is different than in Ontario, where the Ontario College has said you must make an effective referral, and they use the word referral. And we certainly heard from many individuals, and particularly the Christian Medical Dental Society, that the word refer was going to be very, very problematic. So we did some polling of registrants and tried to, again, look how we could reconcile that. And we've landed in a space where there is still an ethical and professional obligation on every physician in this province to give the patients enough information so that they actually know that it is lawfully available. So if a patient asks about it, you can't say it's not available. You can't misrepresent that. There is an expectation that if you don't want to be part of that, that you would share that with your patient, but also acknowledge that you, the physician, have an obligation to assist that patient in transferring their care somewhere else. We didn't use the word refer, we used the word transfer. And the good news is that every single health authority in the province has actually developed a MAID care coordinator. So there is sort of, if you like, that 1-800 number that people can actually call and navigate. We've been very clear with physicians they must not abandon care, and they're not allowed to badger their patient or try to impose their value system on. That's not being ethical and professional. So when I do speak to groups of physicians, I like to remind them that this is a highly vulnerable population for whom simply saying, well, and here's the 1-800 number, is probably not going to be enough. They may have mobility impairment. They may have visual impairments. They may not actually have access to a telephone or a computer. And their obligation is to figure out what assist is going to look like, because it's got to be meaningful. And my call to those who are conscientious objectors is that we would really like to reconcile that, but your ethical and professional obligations can't be barriers to accessing care. That otherwise the public interest and the patient interest would be that we would actually have to go to using the word refer, which we don't want to do. And for those of you who read the media, you know that a week doesn't go by that we don't have a bioethicist talking about how can you be part of the healthcare system and not be obliged to refer, and then the next ethicist saying, we don't want any part of this, and it is still of great debate amongst all of us. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Cynthia and have her talk about the registered nursing aspect.
So Heidi's actually covered off most of the issues that the nursing group has, which is important. I think one thing I'd like to highlight about this change, particularly in British Columbia, is the collaborative nature of the work between the College of Physicians and Surgeons, the College of Registered Nurses, and the College of Pharmacists, in addition to all of the health authorities, the Coroner's Office, the Ministry of Health. It's been an incredible journey for all of us to go through working on not only a provincial regulatory change, but the actual implementation. For the nursing group in particular, I think for our registrants, the issue really around conscientious objection has been the biggest hurdle for most of them. So when I talk to my staff about what are our practice calls around this matter, it's around conscientious objection and trying to nuance the work that nurses do in palliative care, which is a long history and a mental model that they experience, versus the patient choosing. And it's a very different kind of choice. So Heidi alluded to the fact that this is the biggest societal change, cultural change that she'll see in her lifetime. I agree. It's substantive, and I think it's reflective of the fact that we have moved to a patient-centered model of care. And in particular, I think in British Columbia, we had a very engaged Minister of Health on this issue. So, for example, nurse practitioners who can assess for medical assistance in dying in British Columbia, that's not the same in some of the other provinces. And that's due in part to the fact that regulations here in British Columbia actually turned over and happened quite quickly. And I actually went online last night to just see whether or not in the BC laws section, whether or not our regulations have been updated with the change. And they still haven't, but it is in effect. So, you know, it's interesting how important and imperative it was, and yet we're still waiting for that actual final regulation to be posted. But in terms of how CRNBC has managed this transition, one thing we did do is work very closely with Heidi and her team around developing standards that align for both nurse practitioners, registered nurses, pharmacists and physicians. And again, because this is such a huge societal shift, I think it's really important that we have aligned our standards and that the expectation we have of our practitioners around managing conscientious objection, the ethical dilemmas that they may experience, we are using the same language, the same messaging, and the same expectations on our websites, in our consultations, in our presentations to registrants across the province. The other thing I want to speak to is around both the College of Physicians and Surgeons and the College of Nurses have indicated that practitioners only do this when they are competent to do it. And one of the challenges has been whether or not you require formal education in order to provide medical assistance in dying. And Heidi often uses the term, see one, do one. Is that your term?
See one, do one, teach one.
Teach one, yeah. And that's actually pretty much what we've done. There isn't formal education in North America, I would think, for medical assistance in dying. We have had a number of practitioners, both nurse practitioners and medical practitioners, who've gone overseas to other countries to seek out more formalized educational opportunities in the way of conferences and continuing education. But in North America, there hasn't been a formal preparatory piece for this particular service. So it is really exactly that. See one, do one, teach one. So I'm going to just flip to the next. I know there are probably people have questions, but again, just to highlight the collaborative nature of this work. And it's, again, from the point of view of a regulator, it's been really important to have consistency in how we set the standards and how we message for our registrants about this change. And that also translates into good care for patients, because the expectation that a patient has of any practitioner involved in medical assistance in dying is now the same.